ebook publishers and marketing services company Just Imagine It, Inc. presents Get Behind Me, Now Stay There, a new fun-filled, informative podcast available on iTunes and right here locally on KSKQ Ashland, Oregon, 89.5 FM. Art and entertainment news and views. Today's podcast is brought to you by the fine folks at Downpour.com, the one stop for all your audio and digital book needs. Join the Downpour Audiobook Club and save up to 50% on digital downloads, exclusive member-only deals and promotions with no commitment, and you can cancel at any time. Only $14.99 per month, that's Downpour.com. On this episode, we catch the bus with artist Amara, Chrissy McIntyre gets tips on comedy at the Gotham City Improv, and the New York Times bestseller, Calico Joe, in our audiobook feature, right after the news you want to know.
Charlie Stanton.
I'm Maya Seligman.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
I'm Jerry Renfro.
I'm Chrissy McIntyre, and here's the news you want to know. New Yorkers are getting ready to high-five their neighbors and throw their hats in the air because the Plus Pool Kickstarter has been fully funded. This is a new project to actually have a pool inside the East River. And what it is it's four separate pools put together in the shape of a plus sign, essentially, and it uses the actual river water. It's a filtration system. So this isn't water that they pipe in with chlorine. No, this is river water that the pool actually filters itself so that you could swim in it. And the goal of the project is to actually clean the river. In the East River, you can't swim in that for like 100 years. And
so this it's pretty grimy.
Yeah.
Like you wouldn't want to get in it. The only time you swim in the East River is if you're sleeping with the fishes, from what I heard.
Oh, okay.
Which, I read this story too, and it sounds like a fantastic idea, you know, filtering the water and using it. I'm just curious. I mean, like, is the filter big enough to, like, filter out dead mobsters and chunks of concrete and things like that? I mean,
yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Well, actually, I believe, from what I understand of this, and I'm not really an engineer or anything, but I believe the whole pool is a filter. So this pool, which is 35 feet by 35 feet, is a filtration system. Now, how it filters it, I mean, I don't really understand all the engineering feats of this, but I mean, I guess the muck or whatever they filter out is removed somehow, and I don't know where it goes. I don't know what they do with that, but the resulting water is swimmable.
Well, I'm more concerned about the shrinkage. Is there going to be shrinkage?
Yes, there is, because that water's cold.
Yeah. A lot more New Yorkers are going to be going, I was in the pool.
Yeah. I was in the pool. So, yeah, it's a very exciting project. So they were on Kickstarter. They were hoping to get $250,000. They exceeded their goal. So now they are going to start on a smaller pool. So to kind of test the whole system, basically.
Kind of like a beta version.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Jerry.
Before they go invest the money in the big one.
Right.
Well, and it looks fascinating. I've seen the pictures.
Fascinating, and they're hopefully, you know, pending funding, which, I mean, it doesn't seem to be a problem so far. The pool will be completed by 2016.
Oh, all right. Well, then we can start planning our parties now.
Mm. Totally. Yeah. Now, I'm curious.
I'll tell you another guy who's probably starting his party, and he will probably perform at the Plus Pool, provided there's no shrinkage, of course, is Jay-Z.
Yeah. And you know, he has a hit song, Picasso Baby. So where do you think he performed it? Could it be maybe an art museum?
Makes sense.
Yeah. It happened. So the hip-hop mogul who just released his album Magna Carta Holy Grail, he rapped the song over and over for 6 hours at New York's Pace Gallery. Quite a performance.
Wow.
Yeah. Mark Romanek, who also worked on Jay-Z's 99 Problems short, he directed cameras to shoot the whole thing for a music video. It's funny because no photography signs were posted for visitors, but tons of onlookers, they whipped out their cell phones like almost immediately. Yeah, of course. Yeah, Romanek, he said it became apparent in the first 3 seconds that there was no way to control it. And then Jay-Z, he ended up like hamming it up. He said, "I'm posing for your picture. See that? It was statuesque." That's what he said. Okay, funny.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, the story became really popular on social media sites. I saw the clips actually myself on YouTube, and there were Twitter comments and everything. One of the videos that I saw on YouTube, it was a performance by a special guest, Marina Abramović. Have you heard of her?
She's the performance artist.
Yeah, yeah. She is known for her exhibition called Marina Abramović, The Artist is Present. And it was done at the Museum of Modern Art in New York about 3 years ago. And in her work, it's quite unique. She sat still at a table for 7.5 hours a day for 3 months. Huh. I mean, I can't even imagine. Quite astounding. And so apparently her show was actually the inspiration for Jay-Z's event. And in this one, Marina, she kind of slunk into the room, taking off her shoes and her belt along the way, and did like a slow, seductive dance. And then she and Jay-Z, they paced around and they were like totally staring into each other's eyes, and they pressed their foreheads together a few times. And it was very interesting.
And then when she walked off stage, did Beyonce jump her and beat the heck out of her? Yeah,
right, you'd think. Well, it was
funny. Get off my man.
That's my man.
It was a little unplanned, actually. Marina, she said afterward, "I had no idea what I was going to do. I just came here and felt the energy. I love his music because it's social issues, it's political, and really goes to everybody's heart. It's so good, it's like a volcano."
Oh.
That's Picasso Baby was the name of the song?
Yeah,
That's really neat.
You can check out the videos online because it's pretty interesting that he's, you know, that we're melding, bringing these two different forms together of, you know, the rap and the art museum. Really, yeah, and cool.
Jay-Z's really becoming synonymous with New York, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, he really is a presence there. You know, and that got me to think.
I don't even think he lives in New York, though. I think he lives in Connecticut, doesn't he, Chrissy?
Does?
I don't know.
Now, you know
I'm not allowed to disclose his address. Only in private.
But Chrissy does want to say that his furniture looks excellent from the lawn.
Absolutely, yes.
You know what I found, is curious, like in this story, is like Jay-Z says that there was a painting. And he said to his daughter, he said, "Go ahead and lean on it. You own that shit."
To his like 2 year old or
right, his little daughter.
Yeah. Yeah.
You own it.
That's classy. You keep it classy, Jay-Z.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? We were gonna sample his song, but you know what, the thing is so filthy. I was like, hey, there's like, just like, you know, there's not a room anywhere.
Can't even get 5 seconds of clean for it. I wonder if any parents complained about that performance.
Oh, I wonder.
And speaking of complaints, I don't know if you guys heard this. It's really funny, but probably the best complaint letter of all time was just recently sent to the president of Liat Airlines, L-I-A-T. It's a small airline that services the Caribbean, about 21 ports in the Caribbean. And, you know, most you expect from a complaint letter, you expect them to be filled with, you know, rage and hate and just vitriol. And so I've seen some complaint letters so bad I felt like I needed to take a shower after it was done. I mean, just the hate. But this letter was completely different. The letter was penned by Arthur Hicks of London to the president of Liat Airlines. The letter was so just downright nice and entertaining. The president actually sent it to another CEO of an airline, Sir Richard Branson, who then retweeted it to his 3 million plus followers. I'm going to read it for you. It's quite
good. I mean, Richard Branson from Virgin?
Yes, the CEO of Virgin Enterprise, Virgin Group. Yep. Who all, you know, Virgin Airlines, Virgin Music, etc. So Richard Branson retweeted this, and here's Sir what Richard it said. Branson.
And is it sarcastic? We'll find out.
You'll find out, yes. It started with, "Dear Liat, may I say how considerate it is of you to enable your passengers such an in-depth and thorough tour of the Caribbean. Most other airlines I have traveled on would simply wish to take me from point A to point B in rather a hurry. I was intrigued that we were allowed to stop at not a lowly one or two, but a magnificent six airports yesterday. And who wants to fly on the same airplane the entire time? We got to change and refuel every step of the way. I particularly enjoyed sampling the security scanners at each and every airport.
Oh, no.
I find it preposterous that people imagine them all to be the same. And as for being patted down by a variety of islanders, well, I feel as if I've been hugged by most of the Caribbean already. I also found it unique that this was all done on island time, because I do like to have time to absorb the atmosphere of the various departure lounges. As for our arrival, well, who wants to have to take a ferry at the end of all that flying anyway? I'm glad the boat was long gone by the time we arrived into Tortola last night, and that all those noisy bars and restaurants were closed. So thank you, Liat. I now truly understand why you are the Caribbean airline. P.S. Keep the bag. I never liked it anyway.
I wonder how the Asiana complaint letter would read.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, did you hear that they're thinking of filing a lawsuit against that TV station down in San Francisco that reported the names of their pilots? Yeah. Some intern called, and the names were all just, like, stereotype, you know. Oh, it's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's horrible. Like, we fly low.
Oh, you know, Sum Ting Wong was one of them. Yeah, and yeah, exactly. So
yeah, he went way out of his job description, or, you know, he wasn't supposed to do that at all.
No, he was an intern, so yeah. I mean, I'm sure he got a good laugh out of it. Now he'll probably get a lawsuit as well. So Richard Branson retweeted that to his followers. He thought it was absolutely hilarious. Richard Branson, of course, is no stranger to complaint letters.
Yeah, and Richard Branson, you know, he's quite a character, and if you've ever flown on Virgin Atlantic, they're great flights, and they show a lot of great movies on there, and they do a lot of fun little things. You know, like we did that story about the flirting and tweeting.
Oh, yeah, the story.
Yeah, and I'm sure that they're showing the Lone Ranger, because that was a great movie.
It was. Yeah, we had a lot of fun watching it.
How did it do in the box office?
Bad. Dismal is the word out on it. But it was a $215 million budget, so, you know, it's got to make a lot of money to make up for what they spent on it already. And unfortunately, it only made $49 million in its first 5 days, you know, for a film of this size and expense. That's not good enough. The film, which was also criticized by critics, is the latest in Hollywood's long saga of failing to transform a genre staple from the mid-20th century into a lucrative 21st century box office draw. Westerns are risky investments, as stories set in the Old West aren't as popular abroad as they used to be, so they face challenges in foreign markets, which today's big movies increasingly rely on to fuel profits. The Lone Ranger was something of a passion project for its makers, in this case, star Depp, director Gore Verbinski, and producer Jerry Bruckheimer, the team behind the Pirates of the Caribbean films.
Which are all wildly successful.
Right, which were wildly successful, $2.6 billion. But unfortunately, that lightning has failed to strike twice.
You know, Si, we went and saw The Lone Ranger, and I really liked it. I thought it was a good movie.
I know that saw it liked it. And, you know, the interesting thing about this is I wonder how much of this is – because it doesn't sound like a bad movie. Everybody I know saw it, liked it. But, you know, in this age of the internet where everybody's trying to be first to, you know, create a bandwagon or jump on a bandwagon, you know, I heard all sorts of dismal reviews for it before the movie even came out. You know, and I wonder how much of that has affected – people that have chosen to go see it, because the Pirates movies were great. You've got that formula. It works. The Lone Ranger, you know, was popular at one time. It really kind of bums me out.
No, I think you hit the nail on the head. You know, it was popular at one time. Now, The Lone Ranger was a TV series in the 50s, and they made a couple movies of it.
And black and white
movies. But like Cyrus was saying, I don't remember the last big Western, you know, I mean, because like, unless it was something really out there, like Django Unchained was a Western.
Right.
But it was like really out there.
Different take on a Western.
Yeah, because really liked Cowboys and Aliens.
I did too. Yeah, Harrison Ford and Daniel Craig. But that one also didn't do very great.
It didn't well.
Wild West, remember Will Smith? That one did.
That didn't do very well for a good reason. It was a terrible movie.
What about Brokeback Mountain?
Well, that was
that's an art house film. We're talking, you know, this is like big budget. Hex was, you know, in all senses a failure. You know, when it doesn't even earn back what it cost.
I think the last big Western movie that I can remember was Russell Crowe and
Christian Bale.
Christian Bale's 310 Yuma.
Oh yeah, but that was seven, eight years ago, I think, at least. I mean, it's been a while. And but if you think about it, the Pirates franchise, what was the big pirate thing before that? There wasn't one.
No, but the thing is Western is eclectic to American culture.
An existing genre.
Pirates, most of the pirates are
not Americans.
Not Americans.
Right, exactly. And you have a good point. The West, that's a strictly American thing that used to have broad appeal. But I think in the age of the internet and instant communication and things like that, I think that the Western genre has just gone by the wayside.
Well, let me give you an example. That they have Western films in Australia about their Western heroes.
Right.
And nobody goes to watch them in the United States.
No, we don't care. It's not our West. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not our West. We don't know the story behind it. But everybody knows the stories of pirates.
Right. And that's a very good point. You know, science fiction themes, these kind of, I guess, the universal themes. And with more and more of Hollywood's revenue coming from the overseas market, they really have to start like taking that into account. Yeah, maybe this is popular in America, but how's it going to do in China? How's it going to do?
Well, you know, because that's what they look at. They look at, you know, like every film in America, whether it's big or small, they always have a second life in the foreign markets.
Often bigger.
Because a lot of people, you know, want to see Hollywood films.
Right.
Just like we want to see, you know, Bollywood films and things like that, or French films. But like the last big Western that I could think of that did really, you know, big at the box office, you know, I mean, huge, was like Butch Cassidy and His Kid, or the
Tombstone did well.
Yeah, or Little Big Man, you know.
Oh, I love that movie.
But yeah, and that was with Dustin Hoffman. And I think Chrissy's got something she wants to tell us about Dustin Hoffman.
Well, he's kind of very popular now with the ladies. He did a little interview with the American Film Institute.
Uh-huh.
And he was discussing his role in Tootsie.
Loved it.
And he basically was saying, when I was watching the video, he was saying, I want you to make me a woman. I want to make this. And like, okay, so make me a woman. So that's a very convincing woman. I don't want to look like a guy in drag. I want to look like a woman. So they do that. When he was done and made up as a woman, he looked at himself and he was like, yeah, but okay, all right. So I look like a woman, but can you make me an attractive woman? And the makeup artist was like, yeah, this is all we got, kid. Like, all we can do. And he was really upset by that. And he went home to his wife and he said, I have to make this movie because, you know, he was really struck by the fact that, like, if he saw himself as a woman in a bar, he wouldn't have gone up to her because he didn't find her physically attractive. And, you know, he said, like, there's a lot of women I haven't met because they didn't physically meet what I would find attractive. And he got all choked up about it. And basically his whole point was, for him, Tootsie was not a comedy. Tootsie was like a real point to make that, you know, beauty is not really like skin deep.
Yeah, beauty's not skin deep. It's like eye opener for him. Mm-hmm. You know, I saw that video. He was just, and the point he was making is like, I have cut myself out of so many potentially beautiful relationships because I judged women by the way they looked, not by who they were.
Right. Yeah. There's so many people you don't meet. He didn't meet me, for starters, right there.
But the fact is, that's not just a strictly male thing. I mean, that ball rolls both ways. You know, I'm sure, you know, women with men with women. But Dustin Hoffman being who he is, obviously, it's, you know, it was a journey of self-discovery for him. I love it. I think the video sounds great. And I hope it really opens some people's eyes to seeing their own prejudices.
Yeah, but Jerry, to your point, though, I think a lot of men go into a relationship, like they'll meet people with the thought that, like, I'm going to hook up with this person.
True.
First and foremost. Like, women don't necessarily do – like, I don't – every guy I see, it's not like I want to, you know, shag him. Sometimes I just want to meet people and find out what they're about.
Right. So then, I think they might have – no, I think that's a good point, Chrissy, because it's like, I think that women – and this could just be my own personal opinion, although I think a lot of people share it, but I think that women look at men as the – are they interesting?
Yeah.
Do they make me
laugh?
Are
they a potential friend?
Do I want to hang out with them?
Yeah.
Right. Because Christie Brinkley wasn't with Billy Joel for his looks. I mean, let's face facts.
She wasn't?
No. I don't know if you've noticed, but Billy Joel's not the most attractive fellow.
It's because he's good with his hands.
That's what it is.
Oh.
Yeah, I watched the video of Hoffman, and it was moving to hear, you know, this epiphany he was having about how women are judged for their appearance. What I like is that this video has taken off so much, and it's gotten so many views.
Yeah, what is it, like 2.8 million views, right. I think, in a week?
And that doesn't even cover the news coverage. Like, it's on, you know, all the major news channels.
Well, and that's just the people that viewed it online, you know, the actual video itself, like who saw, you know what I'm saying, who actually saw the video. So that it's probably even much higher number than that.
Right, of course.
Probably more people saw that video than saw the movie.
But maybe they're inspired to now want to see the movie.
But, you know, I think it's really interesting, you know, Charlie, what you were saying, and Chrissy, you as well, you know, about how men and women, you know, look at these things differently. And I think you're right. You know, men for more so, you know, do look at women, you know, in that, I don't know, sexual way earlier on, you know, maybe than a woman looks at a man. You know, I mean, sex is a big part of everything that we do
I think that we all you know look first, right? Are you attracted? There's gonna be some sort of animal attractiveness. I just think that women need to take the whole picture into account. They don't disregard us because of the way we look. We would disregard them because of the way they look.
Probably.
You know what I mean?
Remember, these are all generalizations. Generalizations.
I think they are.
You know, it's all individual, I think.
Yeah.
Right. What was that? I was just making a broad generalization. No, you were making a generalization about broads.
Good one. Yeah. Well, it's interesting because Amanda Seyfried,
I am attracted to.
Yeah, you are. Talk about gender roles and stuff. She recently shed her pristine nice girl kind of image by playing a very racy role in the new film Lovelace, because she plays porn sensation Linda Lovelace.
Wow.
Yeah. So Seyfried, the 27-year-old actress, she said, "I read the script and I was like, wow, this is the riskiest thing that's happening in Hollywood right now. I could have ruined my career. At the same time, I was like, this is my chance to show them, to be recognized." That was her reflection. And so the film, directed by Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman, premiered at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year, and it got really positive reviews. It covers everything from Lovelace's, her humble beginnings, to her glamorous life as the star of course, Deep Throat. And it ended with her activist days when Lovelace spoke out against the industry that actually made her famous. And so Seyfried, she said, "I had a hard time letting go of Linda at the end of the movie." Yeah.
Wow.
Oh. You know,
I'm sure the porn industry would be happy to accept.
Yeah.
You know what, Chrissy? This is really kind of trippy. And it's like when I first saw this story, Maya, I was like, Amanda Seyfried, right? I never put the two together because, you know, she was in, you know, Les Miserables, you know, you know, I'm just like, whoa, this is like a complete departure from her, because another role originally was going to go to Lindsay Lohan.
For the Linda Lovelace?
Like
for
that
Linda
you Lovelace. Could totally see, right?
Right. I thought, well, that's a good casting, right?
Right.
Yeah, I can imagine that. But, well, it's interesting because, so she does play Cosette in Les Miserables, who is a young object of desire. But interestingly enough, some would say that her character is really typically quite sexless. And traditionally, neither Cosette nor Marius, her husband, they're not even aware of the existence of, like, carnal desire. So we'll see contrast of those two roles that she's playing.
I know, because this is just a woman is all over the place. You know, Les Miserables, she was in, you know, Mamma Mia. And I'm like, these are all like, you know, grade A American wholesome, you know, films. And I'm also Linda Lovelace in Deep Throat.
Right. And she got her start on Big Love, you know, where she played the daughter of a Mormon family. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, she's not known for that. Yeah. I'm really interested to see this because I read recently that when accounting for inflation, Deep Throat was the highest grossing movie of the 1970s, even more so than Star Wars. So
that's fascinating.
Yeah, you know what? I remember when it came out, you know, Deep Throat. And, you know, I mean, it's like everybody – this is interesting because – it was back then. Everything was X, so you know you couldn't go see it unless you were an adult, you know, and you couldn't. There was no way to watch it at home or stream it on the internet or anything like that. You had to go to the movie theater. And for the first time, you know, in modern history, people were lining up in groves to go see
an X-rated film.
It was a pornographic film, dude, you know, and it's a porno with a loosely based plot, you know, and.
people, but you know, your mom and dad, you know, your neighbors down the street, everybody went and saw it. Like, this is the first time, you know, in history, people were like, oh my God, there's oral sex. I can't believe it. Where's this been all this time? You know?
Where have you been all my life?
Yeah. Well, it's funny because Seyfried, who we think like is this innocent girl, she's on next month's Elle magazine. Uh-huh. And it next to the headline on the magazine, it says a quote by her. She says, sex motivates everything. It's what people want to explore.
Yeah, I hope this movie works out for her. I hope she doesn't blow it.
Yeah. Yeah. Nicely done. Very nicely done.
Give a warning for that. Oh,
well, hopefully, in case it does ruin her career, which I doubt it will in today's society, hopefully she saves and invests her money well. Because I'll tell you, a guy who has done well for himself and saved his money is Jared Fogle, the Subway spokesman. It's 15 years ago that he became the face of the Subway franchise. And wow. I'm sure you guys all know who Jared is, right? I mean, he's done over 300 commercials for Subway. And
he's on TV more than Oprah.
It seems like it, yeah. Frankly, he couldn't be happier and Subway couldn't be happier. After he aired his first commercial for them, their revenue went up 20%. And in the time since he's been their spokesman from 1998 till now, they've gone from an average revenue around $3 billion a year to $11.5 billion in 2011.
Wow. Jeez. I hope he's getting compensated.
He won't say what he's getting, but he is. He said he's doing well. It's been a great.
I think they bumped him up to a large sandwich now.
Well, no. Yeah, right. It's all he can eat. He has a Subway Black Card, one of only a few in existence, where he can go into any Subway and get whatever he wants. And he flies around. I mean, this is his job. It's the only job he's ever known. Jared was a 425-pound junior in college, living off quarter pounders, French fries, and all-you-can-eat Chinese buffet. And he was very antisocial. He didn't want to go out. He was embarrassed about his weight. And one day he walked into a Subway. He said he created the Subway diet himself, the, you know, 6-inch for lunch and a 12-inch veggie for dinner. And he lost 235 pounds in 11 months. And
wow, you know, that is amazing.
It's remarkable. The reason he became known was the paper at his school did an article on him, showed him holding up his old size 60 pants. It came to the attention of Subway. They flew him out, made a commercial, and the rest is history.
You know what? I'm just curious, you guys. Do you think that Subway diet really would work? Because I've often said to myself, I'm just going to do that Subway thing. But the deal is, man, it's like, I just couldn't eat a Subway sandwich. I don't care every day. Yeah, I'd be like,
I'd get a little tired of it.
I could. Yeah.
Of course,
if somebody else paid for it,
ate
I'd do it.
Cheeseburgers, yeah, and then he went to a turkey sandwich. I mean, like the calorie difference is
huge.
Astronomical.
Astronomical, absolutely. And the big thing is
all you can eat Chinese buffet. Come on, that's an outrageous amount of calories.
Like four or five plates.
He talked about that. Yeah, four or five plates at a time. His goal was to leave as full as he possibly could.
Well, you got to get your money's worth.
Yeah. Well, he said he never got tired of Subway. He did crave other things, but he had to basically just like hold himself in his room because he knew if he went out, he would go get in the drive-thru. The Subway restaurant, you know, they consider him part of the family. He was on Oprah, you know, right after he filmed that first commercial. He's done well, and he just keeps doing it. He has a 20-month-old baby. He said that, you know, being the face of Subway has afforded him opportunities he never thought he could get.
Yeah, you know what? It's great, and he's been able to maintain, you know, the weight that he's at, and then he kept his money, and he made, you know.
He's got a net worth of like $15 million or something like that.
Right, which is right on par with the people from 50 Shades of Grey, I think.
Yeah, they're making a lot of money too, and the books were successful, and now they're going to be having a movie, which should be successful too. So Sam Taylor Johnson has been named the official director of the screenplay adaptation. So everybody's looking forward to that. You know, she's a great director. Her unique ability to gracefully showcase complex relationships dealing with love, emotion, and sexual chemistry are making her the ideal candidate, said the co-producer, Michael DeLuca, in his official press release. E.L. James's characters and vivid storytelling require a director who is willing to take risks and push the envelope where needed, and Sam is a natural fit. Sam Taylor Johnson, Charlie, you might remember, Nowhere Boy.
Great movie. That was a great movie.
She directed that. That was like her debut. She was also a famed photographer and visual artist. So, you know, she might be able to get into this 50 Shades of Grey book and kind of, you know, bring it to life on the big screen.
You know, I've heard so much about that site. You know, we've done, you know, stories on it, and, you know, it seems like so many people have read the book. And when the movie comes out, I'm just, you know, wondering if it's going to, you know, live up to all this, you know, high expectations. Because it's you know, when something's really super, you set the bar so high, right? And it sometimes, you know, it hinders, you know, what you do next.
Yeah, sometimes it doesn't translate, or sometimes the hype is set, so the bar is set so high that it's not even attainable.
Yeah, and then so sometimes, you know, people are looking for you to like, you know, duplicate what you've done before, or they have expectations, as you were saying, you know, about, you know, what you're going to do and what they expect from you. And it can be so overwhelming that some people, you know, have to change their name to do a new project. Isn't that right, Chrissy?
That's absolutely right. J.K. Rowling, as you know, has wrote all those Harry Potter books. But she wrote a crime novel, and she wrote it under a pseudonym of Robert Galbraith. And it was a very good book, and everyone was, you know, people were buying it and everything. But her cover was blown, and it came out in the news of the Sunday Times newspaper that she was actually the writer of it, and not this Robert Galbraith. It's called The Cuckoo's Calling.
Great book, too.
It sold around 1,500 copies in hardback, but after Rowling's name came out as the author, all of a sudden, the book's flying off the shelves.
Let me guess, rocketed up the charts.
Yeah, a little bit. But apparently, the leaker turned out to be a partner at Russell's Solicitors, which is a media company that had knowledge of the secret. The partner of this company told his wife, and then she tweeted it to writer Indian Knight. So then, of course,
you see what that pillow talk does, man.
Just goes to show you can't trust your significant other with secrets.
Absolutely. So Rowling is reportedly very angry that her trust was misplaced with this company because she really wanted to keep this secret a little longer because she said it's been such a liberating experience. It's been wonderful to publish without hype or expectation and the pure pleasure to get feedback under a different name. That's my J.K. Rowling impression.
Good job. That was great.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess it is exciting. You know, you think, like, are people just buying my books because I wrote Harry Potter?
Because I'm,
you know,
J.K. Rowling.
Yeah. So, and they were buying it. People said it was a good book, but it was, of course, now, you know, now she'll have to come up with a new name.
That's a shame. I wish it had lasted longer. I love the idea. I love finding out later, you know, oh, well, that was also, you know, that was J.K. Rowling. And I think it's really cool because it shows that she's a real writer. She wasn't just one person who had one good idea, but a legitimate best-selling author.
Yeah. You know, and a lot of really famous writers will use a pseudonym too. Stephen King does that. He writes as a doctor, as Jeffrey somewhere or other. And, you know, some people just use synonyms and they don't use their real name, you know, like Lady Gaga.
No, and that...
That's not her real name?
That's not her real name. No, it's not.
Her parents didn't name her that?
It's on her birth certificate. I saw her birth certificate. Yeah. And
now you know. It might be now.
Yeah. Well, she's going to be releasing a new album this November. It's called Art Pop.
Cool.
Yeah. And it was announced on a recent post on her Facebook page. I went and checked it out, and it actually has a picture of her, has this tattoo on her arm that says Art Pop, and it calls the release date a big bang. Yeah.
What does that mean?
Oh, yeah. Well, it was actually like really abstract when I was reading it. It said that the album, quote, musically mirrors Gaga's creative process as she passes through the mediums of each artist she collaborates with. And that Art Pop could mean anything. So it's hard to tell, like, what exactly that means.
I wonder if she's ever going to collaborate with Jay-Z.
Yeah.
He's in the news a lot.
Well, the cool thing is that the album is coming out alongside an app that combines music and art, fashion, and technology. So in a recent announcement, she said that the app is going to help the user share in the adrenaline of fame as they build and share their own projects.
Very interesting. So maybe like a Twitter, Instagram kind of thing for musical creation or musical lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds interesting.
You know, I've never seen her in concert or listened to any of her CDs, you know, from start to finish. But I did see an HBO special that she did. And the thing that I was impressed with, I was like, dang, this woman is a very good musician.
Yeah, she's talented.
I agree. I like, and it's weird. I mean, you guys can physically see me and nobody else can, but I do not look like somebody who would be a typical Lady Gaga fan. But I actually like her music. I think it's inventive.
Well, I'll see you bust a few moves and you guys dance remarkably similar.
Well, I'm not saying I'm not a good dancer. Oh, I mean, yeah. I'm just saying I don't have that traditional look.
Hey, Maya, you ever have a question and you just don't know where to start, where to go to answer it?
Yeah, definitely. But when I don't know, I go to Jerry Renfro. He's the guy in the know.
That's right. I'm Jerry Renfro, and I am the guy in the know. Celebrities. They entertain us and amaze us. We read about their exploits, ridiculous as they may be sometimes. Arguably, we watch some of them just for the train wreck effect. I'm looking at you, Lindsay Lohan and Amanda Bynes. But some celebrities work prominently towards causes that are important to their heart, like animal rights, Pamela Anderson, or affordable housing for low-income families, Brad Pitt. With the wealth of coverage provided by magazines like OK and People and TV shows like Extra and Entertainment Weekly, you'd think we know pretty much everything there is to know about celebrities. But I've got some information you may or may not know. Some celebrities do more than just act.
Really?
Shocking. In fact, these celebrities have what you
get out of town.
I'm
man.
Telling you the truth. These celebrities have advanced degrees in fields you might not know. Now, it's not that big of a stretch of the imagination to see that Sigourney Weaver has a Master's of Fine Arts from Yale.
It is
makes
for
sense,
me.
Right? Well, no, because she's an actress. She's, you know, she's been around. So it's having an acting degree is not so strange. But you guys remember Danica McKellar? She was Winnie from The Wonder Years.
Sure,
of course.
A TV
show back in the, yeah. She has a master's in mathematics from UCLA and is the author of a series of children's books, of middle school age books for getting kids into liking math.
Wow.
Art Garfunkel, Simon and Garfunkel, mm-hmm. Mrs. Robinson, right? Also has a master's in mathematics from Columbia University.
Wow. Now, he looks like a brainiac.
He kind of does. He's got the hair for
He's
it.
Got the Einstein thing
He's
going on.
He's got the Einstein thing going on. Dolph Lundgren, 80s action star, He-Man, Masters of the Universe, those kind of things.
And from Rocky, too.
That's right. Ivan Drago from Rocky IV.
I must break you.
Well, what he's actually breaking down is chemical compounds because he's has a master's in chemical engineering from the University of Sydney. And he was a Fulbright scholar to MIT.
Whoa.
Wow.
But
wow.
He got discovered by Grace Jones, hired as her bodyguard, and the rest is history. Mm-hmm. Rowan Atkinson.
Why would you take that job?
I know. It's
You're
crazy.
Like a brilliant person, and you're going to be a bodyguard?
Yeah, well, he's a third Dan in some type of karate, and he hosted tournaments and things like that, so obviously he's in great shape, and he just wanted to see what would come of it, and he's got a great career out of it. Rowan Atkinson, Mr. Bean, has a master's in electrical engineering from Oxford. Peter Weller, RoboCop, Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai. PhD in Italian Renaissance art history from UCLA.
See, now that makes sense.
Wow.
Right, totally makes sense, right? All right, yeah, well, if you think that's impressive, Mayim Bialik, you know, from Blossom back in the 90s.
Oh,
and now
yeah.
She's on The Big Bang Theory. She plays Sheldon's girlfriend, Amy Farrah Fowler.
Right.
Has a PhD in neuroscience from UCLA. She was accepted to Harvard and Yale, but she wanted to stay close to her
family.
So she's
the only one on The Big Bang Theory that really is
that
a nerd.
Actually is a nerd, exactly. Here's a funny one. Ron Jeremy, the porn star?
Yeah.
Who's he?
Yeah. The hedgehog?
You know.
Has a master's in special education. He was a special education teacher before he made his leap into film.
Wow.
Now, I saved the best two for last. One of these is really shocking. These are false. Okay. Ken Jeong. From The Hangover, played Leslie Chow, the gangster, and Community Senor Chang. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
was
yeah.
actually
commercial, right?
What's that?
He's in the commercial too, right? The Bud Light commercials.
Yes, was actually a practicing physician before he became an actor.
Wow!
He spent 10 years as a practicing physician. He got his he graduated from Duke with his undergraduate and got his doctor certification at University of North Carolina. I think he worked in New Orleans or something like at a hospital before he decided to try his hand at acting. And my favorite, Brian May, the lead guitarist of Queen.
Right.
Yes. And if you don't know, Brian May has a PhD. Any guesses in what field?
Astronomy.
You're close. Astrophysics.
Wow.
Whoa.
Yes. Not only does he have a PhD in astrophysics, he teaches at the John Moores College in Liverpool.
You know, I did know that about Brian May. because I've seen him interviewed many times, and they refer to him as Dr. May.
Yes, Dr. May, astrophysicist, singer, writer, astrophysicist.
And that's a long way from mega rock star with Queen and Freddie Mercury to teaching
astrophysics.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to point out that not every celebrity blows their money on coke and expensive cars.
Very encouraging.
Yeah. Yes.
And now you know.
And that's your art and entertainment news. Keep listening for Downpour's special feature.
Artist Amara returns to Get Behind Me Now, Stay There with her new art project, Catch the Bus. She explains it all to the president of Just Imagine It, Inc., Charlie Stanton.
Love that guy.
Hello.
Hello, Amara. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. How's everything going out there in New York?
Oh, it's bright and sunshiny today.
So let's talk about Catch the Bus, because it's really a fascinating concept, and I like it. So we're from Ashland, Oregon. We are a small town here in the Pacific Northwest. Let's say the bus comes rolling up to us. What kind of experiences can we look forward to?
Well, you can look forward to the bus itself, which is certainly going to be something different than you've seen before. It's going to be a school bus, and the whole exterior is going to be painted and very unique. The roof of it is going to have solar panels attached on it, and we've looked at several different kinds. We're not exactly sure what we're going to go with yet, but it's also going to have wind tubes, which is an idea that comes out of the Geek Squad. They came up with an idea to put computer fans in a tube, and when wind goes down it rotates all of the fans. And that generates electricity.
Wow.
In addition, we're going to have water collectors that are based on some Japanese models. They use bamboo. We're going to be using PVC pipe. But the theory remains the same.
It does.
And the reason that we're going to all this length and effort is because it is going to be a smart studio. Living in the age of technology, it seems simply foolhardy not to make use of that. How many generations before us have had something as phenomenal as the internet at their fingertips, and how many generations after us are going to get to have it? I mean, it's a very, kind of a house of cards.
Well, I think that future generations, of course, will have the internet, but they will have a very toned down version of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So right now we're at the pioneer stages, which reminds me of when I came from New York to Ashland. I was in a covered wagon, but we didn't even have Wi-Fi. I don't know what the story was, but we did have smoke signals, so that kind of worked out. Well, we used to just meet in the middle of the street at high noon and settle that thing right then and there.
Now we have drones. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. Now we send the drones. We say, dang, it's too damn hot to go out there, man. Send the drone.
We'll put them on either end of the street. They can shoot it out.
Yeah. You could even put that on your bus. You could put you could paint a little on the back of the tag. You could say, my other bus is the drone.
Well, the back of the bus is reserved. One of our rewards for donating at the highest level is actually to sign the bus.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So we'll hand deliver a painting to somebody's house and then give them a big paintbrush and they get to sign the back of the bus.
So when is the bus adventure going to begin? Do you have a target date?
Well, the campaign runs until August 11th. But the nice thing about Indiegogo, as opposed to some of the other crowdsourcing platforms, is that as people give, we get the funds right away.
Oh, so, I didn't know that.
As soon as we reach that $3,000 mark, we are going to go out and get the bus and start posting updates on the site of, what we're doing to it. So hopefully before the end of the summer, we'll be well on our way towards catching that bus.
You know, that's great. And I hope you guys come back to the Pacific Northwest. I have a sneaky suspicion you probably will because you have a lot of fans in the Seattle area.
Oh, I have no doubt we'll make it to the West Coast.
So where did this idea come from? Was this your idea?
Well, it was definitely a collaborative idea. We have been living in a livery barn in upstate New York for about a year and a half now. And we're kind of nomadic at heart. So staying in one place has been a little bit challenging. And when we decided that, you know, it was time to think about heading out on the road again, we wondered how to best achieve that. Because the first time we traveled, we were in a Kia Rio all the way across the country for 6 months. We lived in the car. Quite literally, which thank goodness it's a comfortable car to sleep in because otherwise I don't know how we could have done it. But we thought we needed perhaps a little bit more space than a car could accomplish. And neither of us are overly fond of the aesthetic of a camper. And beyond that, they're already set up in a very specific way. And it's a way that's logical to a point for most people, but for us and for what we need in our living space, we would have to tear the entire interior out anyway. And we started going online and looking at things that other artists have done and immediately hit on a website called schoolies.net. And it's an entire website of people who have renovated school buses. And it was obvious that this was what we needed. So we started researching. I started learning more about electricity and electrical systems than I ever thought I wanted to know. And he started learning about diesel engines and biodiesel. And here we are.
On your travels here, you know, and, you know, the Catch the Bus comes into your town and you guys do your thing. And but along the way on the road, because you are very nomadic, are you guys going to be like picking up strange people along the way?
Oh, I have absolutely no doubt of that. And some will probably even be people that we haven't met before. We've had a lot of friends and other artists who are also semi-nomadic or enjoy brief stints of nomadic lifestyle who've asked us if they can catch the bus and get a ride from place to place. And we're very excited about that because we don't want it to become something that is exclusively our own art.
Oh, that's fantastic.
We enjoy the collaborative process of other artists and the inspiration that they bring and the work that they leave with us, because a lot of our artist friends, when they come, leave a CD or they have a painting that they trade us or whatever it is that they do. And we want to be able to bring those things to people too.
You know, that's so cool because, you know, we had a group, a rock and roll group. They're called Jive Cooley, which is French for sauce, you know. And anyway, they're a rock band and they're out of Colorado. And they came here to Ashland to play at some venues. But they came with their bus. They have a school bus.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and it runs on vegetable oil.
Yep, that's one of the things that we're doing. It's actually surprisingly easy to make vegetable oil or biodiesel. Requires a couple of chemicals and a hand drill and some very specific knowledge about the order that things go in. But other than that, you really can have a 5-gallon jug going creating biodiesel for your bus all day long, every day. And throughout the country, when we traveled to LA about 3 months ago, we started asking places, you know, hey, do you give your vegetable oil away to people who need it? And a lot of places were like, hell yes, because they have to pay to have it shipped, you know, to have it taken away otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I don't know what happens to it when they pay people to take it away, but I know that we can put good use to it and that it's actually a cleaner for your engine and a cleaner output.
So how's the painting going? Now, we talked about your Catch the Bus, but are you still painting?
Oh, of course. I can no more stop painting than I can stop breathing. I did a series of paintings over the winter called Gild the Lily.
Okay.
And they're, it's a series of four paintings in oil. I've just started working in oil, and I'm really enjoying the textural quality of it and walking away from the painting and having it still wet when I come back 2 days later. But Gild the Lily is based on photographs of Lily Simmons. She was our punk rock princess in Fat Kid Rules the World, and now she's on a show on Cinemax called Banshee. And she's just the most beautiful human being I've ever met. She's physically gorgeous, and beyond that, she's an absolute sweetheart. There's not an ounce of vanity in her, which is amazing for someone who grew up in, you know, LA and started modeling at the age of 16 and is now, you know, really on the rise to fame and fortune. And she's been trying to meet up with me at some point to do a live modeling session, but we've both been so busy that we haven't gotten the chance to yet.
Wow. The trip to LA was a success then, huh?
It was a success. I got to sing karaoke in a bar in LA.
So and what did you sing?
I sang a Tori Amos song, and okay. I sang the Sheryl Crow song that starts with "Say No Country Club." This is L.A. and the bar went wild. And then I stumbled my way through the rest of the song, and they all clapped generously.
This ain't no disco. It ain't no country club either. This is L.A. A little fun before I die, says the man next to me out of nowhere.
Why don't we give everybody, all of our listening audience out there, where they can get all this great information? Of course, you're going to be on justimagineinc.com, but where else? Either Catch the Buses on Indiegogo.
So, Catch the Buses on Indiegogo. So if you type in Indie, IndieGogo.com. And you search Catch the Bus, the page will come up, and there are, I think, three videos up about and dealing with Catch the Bus right now. And there are rewards starting at the $10 level and going all the way up to $2,000. And we're asking that people just give what they can. You know, we don't want people to stretch themselves. We want people to be a part of it. And once you're a part of it, you'll be getting updates all the time. Your rewards will come to you, and hopefully you'll get a chance to catch the bus when we come through your town.
That is going to be great, and I encourage everyone to go out there and make a donation. You can get anything from, you know, digital art to, you know, a signed DVD to a painting. You know, or maybe you can sign the back of the bus yourself. But I encourage everybody to go there and make some sort of donation. Of course, you can see Amara on her, do you have a Facebook page as well?
Of course. You can catch me on Facebook at The Artist Amara. And I'm on Twitter, Artist Amara. And my website is at weebly.com/AmaraArt.
To learn more about Artist Amara, visit us on our website at justimagineinc.com.
Brandon Bayless and Lulu French form a powerful improv comedy duo. They shared a few laughs with our New York correspondent, Chrissy McIntyre.
Hey everyone, welcome to Get Behind Me, Now Stay There. I am here with the comedy duo, Bayless and French.
Yay!
Okay, so you do improv.
Yes.
So now, I want to know, A, why would you want to do that? Because it seems very scary. And B, why, what prompted you?
I've got my own demons for that.
I find improv to be far easier than working with a script. I get stage fright. Okay. Surprisingly, maybe. Some people would be surprised by
no,
that.
No, I do too. I understand.
And when I'm improvising, I am so completely out of my head. I'm very focused on what's happening in the moment. And mm-hmm. I'm having to catalog everything that's happening in my mind and take everything in and react to what's happening in the moment. So I really don't have time to think. You know, the moment I step out on stage, the audience disappears and I'm just very much concentrating on what I'm doing. If I have a script, I'm thinking, okay, what's my next line? Oh gosh, yeah. I hope I don't forget my next line. Yeah. And there's so much freedom in improvisation. You can do anything, yeah. You know?
Nothing is wrong. Nothing you do is wrong. If you're on stage with someone, they'll just accept what you did and it's completely right. So no matter what you say is right, you don't have to be nervous. I think I do it because it's like therapy. If I can organically bring up something in my real life that kind of plays into the scene, like let's say I woke up this morning, I stubbed my toe. And then in the scene, I kind of stubbed my toe. Even though my foot actually hurts in real life,
yeah.
If the audience enjoys this moment, it makes my toe feel better. Do you know what I mean? That's kind of why I do it a little bit. It's like therapeutic.
You stub your toe a lot, I guess.
I do stub my toe a lot.
Elbow, you got tennis elbow.
I'm sitting here in this chair black and blue.
Yeah.
Just for, if you're listening, my whole body's black and blue.
When does the neck brace come off?
2 weeks, they said. I do always say, though, good improv, when you walk off stage, you feel wholly satisfied. Like Lulu said, there are no lines, so you can just not think. You can trust yourself to just get out there and try things. And especially with a partner like Lulu, we don't have to worry. Like, she'll say something, and she'll just put it out there, and I will make it right, or vice versa. So we don't have to be scared that we'll be left hanging out on stage, or we have to guide the audience to a laugh. We'll get there.
You're not worried about like the constant laugh?
No.
Okay. No, you know, when there is no laughter, like maybe like I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be fun.
Yeah.
And then there's nothing. It calms me down instantly.
Oh.
Like that is totally wipes away the nerves and like I focus in even more.
Huh. So now, do you take suggestions from the audience?
We do.
Yeah, we decided to get the theme for our show from the audience.
When you say the theme from the show, is it one theme? Is it several? Do you do
one theme? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a quick interview. Like, we'll get out there, we'll be like, hey, thanks for coming. We'll ask some questions, and if we see someone who's willing to talk about their day, we'll talk about their day with them.
Okay.
And then from that, we'll extrapolate a theme from their day.
Yeah,
we'll
we'd ask them something like, Chrissy, mm-hmm. How's it going?
Yeah, pretty good. Meeting some friends, having a good time.
Have you had any like challenges in your life lately, or maybe something that you've been struggling with that you might be willing to share?
What's the hardest thing you did today?
Waking up. That was rough.
How did things resolve itself? You know, after you woke up and it was rough. You know, like,
was it worth getting up today?
I mean, was it? How did things turn out?
Yeah, it was good. This is like, wait a second. I'm supposed to do the questions.
It's therapy for everyone.
Yeah.
Just be honest. That's the thing is, the more honest you are, the more natural it is for everyone.
Yeah.
Performer, audience member.
Yeah.
Just talking. It's just like an interview, a radio interview.
Huh. So, if you were in the audience just now and we were talking to you and you were telling us this story, then we might say something like, okay, so in the beginning it was rough, but it eventually worked itself out.
You know, if you work hard, you'll get the job done.
Yeah, if you work hard, you'll get the job done. And then we start the show.
But then, now what are you extrapolating out of this?
I concentrate more on the theme that we boil it down to. So if it's gonna be things start out rough and then they turn out okay. Like at the top of a scene, I might find myself in a situation that I feel is rough. Like that is like, as much as I will get from it, that'll inspire.
So then what do you say? Like, what would you say after that?
I'd probably be struggling in something physical.
Yeah.
She's very, maybe. We actually both are. We set up our physical work a lot very early, and that informs our characters.
Okay.
So for what we'd say, like, maybe she'd be, you know, struggling, and then I could walk in and see her hands like this, close together.
Okay.
Looking like maybe they're chained together, and I could say, you better get out on that field.
Right.
And you better, you know, you have to do this public service or you're going back to jail. Something like that.
Okay.
To start the scene.
Oh.
Yeah, and then we let the theme go from there on. But it helps at the beginning, you know, starting a scene maybe to inspire just the first.
Now, how do you not break?
Oh, we do.
Oh, okay.
I'm a giggler.
Okay. Brandon cracks me up. He's so funny. I like performing with him.
Go on.
Please.
No, you are too, Lou. I know what you mean completely.
The audience enjoys it. They like seeing us having a good time.
I always love watching like the blooper reels. That's like my favorite part of the movie.
Yeah.
Watching them break. So I mean that doesn't bother me, but I didn't know if you had it was like any kind of rules. Maybe we should get into some of the rules of improv and talk
rules.
About
rules. There are rules and then there are no rules.
Once you've solidified them, they're gone.
They are guidelines.
Guidelines, sorry.
Guidelines.
Suggestions.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. You don't want to, for instance, ask questions. You want to add facts to the storyline. You don't want to say, hey, how are you? okay. to you, Chrissy, I would say, you don't look so good.
Oh, I see, I see.
I'll tell you how you are.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And then from there, you'll tell me how I should feel about how you are.
I see.
Back and forth.
Okay, so you don't ask questions. What else would you... I know the yes and.
Yes Whoa. And. Agree, assume. And then you add on to it, basically.
What else do I need?
Yes and.
Yes and.
You no don't want to deny people anything.
Don't deny. Ooh, so what does
yeah,
that mean?
That's a bad one.
You know, for instance, I'll say... I'll hold a fake glass in my hand. I'll say, Lulu, take this glass from me. She'll say, that's a microphone. I mean, I just told her it was a glass. Now she has messed up the whole reality. You know, you never deny like that. But I could say, honey, could you grab my keys so we could get out of here? She could be like, I don't think we should go. Or no, I'm not going to give you those keys. And then we're going to discuss why we're not leaving to go.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah, no, I see the difference. I see the distinction.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's hard to know when to say no. It's really something that you figure out as you go along. Because sometimes it's really fun for the audience to see people doing things that they don't want to do. So you have to say yes to the action. If it's like, son, eat your broccoli. If you're like, no, I don't want to. Eat your broccoli. No, I don't want to. That can get really laborious for the audience. We want to see that kid eating the broccoli and you know, like gagging. Yeah. That's what we want to see. So that's like saying yes to it, but not giving up on that emotional impulse to hate it.
So then how do you know as you're improvising that you're done?
Ooh, 30 minutes have passed. Oh, okay. 25 to 30 minutes. Yeah. Ending a long form is one of the hardest things to do.
We have Lisa's in the booth for us, and you can really rely on the person in the booth because that person, if you have the capability, can black it out. Black out the stage. Turn the lights off.
Oh, okay. Right.
A really good button.
On a good button. What is that?
A button is like... it's the punchline.
Oh, okay.
Of a joke would be the button. It would be the punchline of a whole 30-minute... improvisation.
You know, it's never like wrapped up in a nice neat little bow,
no,
you know,
of course.
Perfectly. But if we can have some type of satisfying conclusion, that's the goal.
Yeah.
Sure.
It's tough, but
do you have a couple of like little opening lines just sort of like packed away for
No.
Okay.
That's the most dangerous thing to do because when you walk into a scene, you have to come in with a very distinct motive and be ready to throw it out the door because it's gonna change. You know, I could walk into a scene being a police officer and I'm about to interrogate Lulu.
Okay.
And Lulu could be walking into the scene being a little girl and with her mommy at the zoo.
Okay.
So if I come in hard like this, she's thinking her mom is angry at her. And when she's like all gentle, I think this assailant, I'm going to get every answer I want out of them. So we have to gently push at each other until we find out who we are.
So you don't know.
Neither of us are going to be. Yeah.
This is scary.
You have to go in with nothing. You are dooming yourself if you do anything that you've rehearsed. It has to be completely, completely fresh.
You'll end up seeming contrived. But that's the charm of improv and why people love it so much and why you can't explain a hilarious improv scene. When you go see awesome improv and you're like, oh, this happened, it's impossible to explain because it all happened in front of you. And you know they made it up, and that's what's so amazing about it.
Right, it just happened.
Yeah. There were no great lines. It's the fact that you were living in that moment with those people that was so charming.
Mm-hmm. So can we try one?
Nope.
You guys...
That's a no end. See what I did there? No, definitely. Yeah.
Deny.
I'm ready if you're ready.
Yeah, so this is speed dating, and it's basically just...
Speed dating. Why don't you come in and sit down?
Oh. Thanks.
Nice to see you. Hi, John.
Hi, John. I'm Jessica.
Hi, Jessica.
We're both J's.
Yeah. Yeah,
John, we are Jessica. Both.
Yeah. Yeah, that's alliteration.
That's hilarious.
I mean, it's funny.
Yeah.
I see here.
Sorry, I like to laugh.
Yeah, no, laughing is very important in a relationship.
It is, right?
Yes.
A good sense of humor, and it's like a number one quality.
Yeah, my parents, actually, they laugh together a lot, so that,
they do. That's important. Hilarious.
I mean, that's not really that funny.
What?
That fact itself
wasn't
that funny.
You can't see the humor. Are you one of these serious people? Oh, I'm serious all the time.
No,
I'm a serious person.
I'm a writer. I write comedy. I'm not serious.
You're a comedy writer. Oh my God, tell me a joke. Oh God, you don't need to tell me one. I can tell it's going to be hilarious.
I actually don't know any jokes. Yeah.
You just said you were a comedy writer.
Yeah, but I write like situational comedy. Like I you know, I, it's a whole world. I have really nothing funny to tell you.
You're just pulling my leg. I'm a comedy writer, but I don't have anything funny to say.
I'm not pulling your leg. I'm just being.
Oh my god! I like you so much.
I'm sorry.
Hilarious.
You don't even know each other.
No, you're great.
Next. There you go. That's one of them.
So, do you have any shows coming up?
Yes, August 2nd.
Okay.
It's a Friday night, 8 o'clock. It's at Gotham City Improv. I don't know if I said that already. www.gothamcityimprov.com.
48 West 21st Street.
Okay.
New York, New York.
With the first half hour of the show is Bayless and French, and the second half hour is Duval.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to be there.
Yay!
Get out. You're going to come?
Absolutely.
I'm honored. Thank you.
Oh, please.
You can go see them too. Just check out their website for upcoming events at brandonbayless.com and lulufrench.com.
To learn more about Brandon Bayless and Lulu French, visit us on our website at justimagineinc.com.
Now batting for the Yankees, number 51, Bernie Williams. Number
Calico Joe, a New York Times bestseller. In the summer of 1973, Joe Castle was the boy wonder of baseball, the greatest rookie anyone had ever seen. The kid from Calico Rock, Arkansas, dazzled Cub fans as he hit home run after home run, politely tipping his hat to the crowd as he shattered all rookie records. Calico Joe quickly became the idol of every baseball fan in America, including Paul Tracy, the young son of a hard-partying and hard-throwing Mets pitcher. On the day that Warren Tracy finally faced Calico Joe, Paul was in the stands, rooting for his idol, but also for his dad. Then Warren threw a fastball that would change their lives forever. In John Grisham's new novel, the baseball is thrilling, but it's what happens off the field that makes Calico Joe a classic.
In the summer of 1973, the country was slowly emerging from the trauma of Vietnam. Spiro Agnew was in trouble and would eventually go down. Watergate was getting hot with much more to come. I was 11 years old and slightly aware of what was happening out there in the real world, but I was wonderfully unburdened by it. Baseball was my world, and little else mattered. My father pitched for the New York Mets, and I lived and died with each game. I pitched, too, for the scrappers in the White Plains Little League, and because my father was who he was, great things were expected of me. I rarely met those expectations, but there were moments of promise. By early July, the pennant race in the National League East had settled into a bland contest. All six teams, Mets, Pirates, Cardinals, Phillies, Cubs, and Expos, were hovering around 500 and showing little enthusiasm for making a run. In the West, the Reds and the Dodgers were pulling away. In the American League, the Oakland A's, with their swagger and colorful uniforms and long hair, were looking to repeat their championship of 1972. My buddies and I followed the game religiously. We knew each player and every statistic. We checked every box score, then replayed the games on the sandlots of White Plains. Life at home was not always pleasant, and my escape was on the field. Baseball was my best friend. And in mid-July 1973, the game was about to be electrified like never before.
Grisham knocks it out of the park, says the Washington Post. John Grisham, whose name has become synonymous with the modern legal thriller, used to work 60 to 70 hours a week at a small South Haven, Mississippi law practice, squeezing in time before going to the office and during courtroom recesses to work on his hobby, writing his first novel. For more information about top-selling titles from this award-winning company, go to downpour.com.
Everybody get up.
Now Stay There is a Just Imagine It Inc. presentation and was recorded in the Blackstone Audio Inc. studios in Ashland, Oregon. If you would like more information about this show, or if you or someone you know would like to be featured, please call us at 541-708-0525 or visit justimagineitinc.com. I'm Maya Seligman.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
I'm Jerry Renfro.
I'm Chrissy McIntyre.
And I'm Charlie Stanton, and we like you, so be sure to like us on Facebook, and remember to get behind me.
Now stay there.